First Name Sports starts now.
We're kind of on a first name basis around here.
On the Sports Map Radio Network.
Okay, let's get started.
From the Sports Map Radio Studios, here's Greg Frank.
What's going on, America? It's Friday afternoon on the Sports Map Radio Network. How are we all doing today? Launching you into the holiday weekend, even though the holiday isn't actually until Tuesday. We'll talk a little bit about that later on in the show as well, but got enough juice here today with some intriguing baseball series, one in the Eastern time zone, one in the Central time zone, and one in the Pacific time zone that are of particularly noteworthy matchups. And in typical First Name Sports fashion, the news breaks yesterday on James Harden about 30 minutes after we get off the air, as we find out that the Sixers guard is going to opt into the final year of his contract with Philly for 23-24, but is doing so in the process to initiate the process of a trade out of Philadelphia. So this was a bit of a middling outcome here with Harden that I don't know that a lot of us were expecting. There were three things that I thought could happen. The least likely being he would opt in and play one season for the Sixers. Now, we know that that's not happening. But when I saw that he was opting in, I thought to myself, oh, you know what? This kind of makes sense. One more year in Philly, see where things are at. I'm sure the Sixers wouldn't mind having him for a year. But in typical modern NBA fashion, and Harden has turned into one of these guys that does this, you know, the expiration date on a certain team seems to come up quicker and quicker, and he's looking to move on. And so while I thought opting in and playing in Philly was the least likely of the three options, the other two that I thought might happen would be he'd either opt out and go back to the Sixers on a multi-year deal, and the Sixers would kind of cave under the fact that there's not many other avenues to improve, or he would just opt out and leave, and whether it was Houston or somewhere else, he would get a multi-year contract from another team. Opting in and being traded was not something I really thought about that much. So that came as a little bit of a surprise. But when you really think about it now, almost 24 hours after the news broke, perhaps this is the best path for all parties in the event of divorce. Because it allows the Sixers to get something back for Harden. He's not just leaving for nothing. And it allows Harden the flexibility of hitting the market again in a year if he doesn't like where he ends up for 23-24. And even if he could have signed somewhere and had full reign over where he went, that's not to say that he wouldn't have whined his way out of that destination in a year. So he only has to be, whether it's the Clippers or the Knicks or whoever, he only has to be there for a year. And if he likes it, he can sign back there. If not, he can go somewhere else next summer. So it works for Harden. And then for the rest of the league, I think there are probably some teams that say, hey, we can trade for him now. He might not have seriously considered us in free agency, but let's try it for a year. And if we have a package that the Sixers like, let's talk to Daryl Morey and see if it works. And these are the risky things that you do when it comes to trading for star-level players in the NBA. You never know if they're going to stick around. And I think a lot of people would laugh if teams think that James Harden is the trade piece that gets them over the hump. But I'm not saying that. That's not to say that somebody wouldn't try it. I mean, I think if Bradley Beal weren't already in Phoenix, the Suns would be very much a player here to perhaps reroute some of the stuff that they sent to the Wizards to the Sixers instead. All of that is to say that I think when it's a trade and not a free agent signing, it opens up some more suitors league-wide. And maybe somebody says, hey, we'll take a one-year dice roll on this, and we know what we have isn't good enough, so what's the harm in parting ways with a couple of role players, things like that. It does seem like the team that we are talking the most about with James Harden is the Los Angeles Clippers. And perhaps they want to try to put him with Kawhi Leonard and Paul George. Because when we're hearing a lot of the rumored packages going back to Philly, it's a lot of the role players for the Clippers. It's Norman Powell. It's Terrence Mann. It's perhaps a reunion with Robert Covington. It's perhaps, you know, I saw, I think it was Kevin O'Connor or The Ringer, his made-up trade had a couple of first-rounders going back to the Sixers who depleted their asset board a little bit when they had to trade for Harden. Remember, they had to attach a couple of first-rounders into that Simmons trade because Ben Simmons wasn't playing for them. So, you know, whatever it ends up being, it does not seem like the Sixers are getting a star-level player back. So, of course, we'll revisit this when the trade happens. But when we view this through the Sixers lens, you have to say, well, are they going to be better in 23-24 without James Harden? Because I think that was the big focal point of why a lot of people, myself included, felt on a short-term deal, it made sense. Ideally, he just opts in and you have him for 1 year. But if he wants 2 or maybe 3 years, you look at that and you think about it because there aren't a lot of other avenues for improvement for Philly. So now what happens with the Sixers if you're talking about trading James Harden for a collection of role players and perhaps even a draft pick or two, not to, you know, to just give yourself some more options to do some other things? And I think the question boils down to, or how you answer that question boils down to how you feel about Tyrese Maxey. I think that if we look at the Nuggets and you look at, you know, probably Milwaukee as well with Giannis and Middleton, you have to say to yourself, these are recent NBA champions that did so with really 2 star-level players, and then they filled out their depth accordingly, and, you know, they went about 9-10 deep and felt pretty good about that. And so if you're the Sixers and you're adding to your depth via the Harden trade and you're getting guys like Norman Powell, Terrence Mann, Robert Covington, etc., then are you confident enough in Tyrese Maxey now morphing into your second star? Can he be the Jamal Murray to Joel Embiid's Nikola Jokic? And I know Joel Embiid needs to grow up, and a lot of these Sixers, you know, kind of successes or failures are all going to be dependent on how much Joel Embiid can morph into that alpha guy in the playoffs that has big games time and time again and doesn't curl up. So we can talk about how the roster looks around Embiid, but if Embiid doesn't get better in the biggest of games, none of this is going to change for the Sixers. And a lot of people are saying, well, if the Sixers get this Harden trade wrong, then Embiid's going to want out. Well, Embiid wanting out, ultimately, as far as his own ability to win a championship, isn't going to change, I don't think. Because if he goes somewhere else, and this guy's attitude and kind of, you know, ability to fold in big spots like we've seen in a lot of big games with the Sixers, if that continues, and it doesn't matter if he's on the Sixers or anybody else, he's not going to win. So ultimately, it's going to be on him to find ways in the playoffs to be the MVP he was in the regular season. But as far as the Sixers team building, and if you're Daryl Morey, what do you do? Well, I think we're going to see if this is really a bet on Tyrese Maxey and that they're just going to fill out their depth and say, hey, we feel better about our 5 through 10 in the rotation now. And Tyrese, you're going to have to be better than you were. And Tyrese Maxey has gotten better every single year of his career. So that's probably what happens here. But then, you know, there's some thought out there from Brian Windhorst, who seems to have survived the you know, the catastrophe at ESPN with all the layoffs. But anyway, Brian Windhorst with a little bit of a slip of the tongue here as to if maybe the Sixers are going to enter the Damian Lillard sweepstakes.
And he absolutely did not. In fact, from what I understand, the tenor of the meeting was that he doesn't want to put pressure on the on the Blazers.
And that's Windhorst talking about a meeting that was held earlier this week between Lillard and the Blazers. And you hear him have a little bit of a slip of the tongue there and say Sixers. Now, the question is, you know, and maybe this is what Daryl Morey is going to kick the tires on these next few days. can he get enough back in a Harden trade to then flip it all to Portland and keep Tyrese Maxey? That's going to be a hard sell. I think if the Sixers get Damian Lillard, they're probably bidding a friendly farewell to Tyrese Maxey. But I'm sure Daryl Morey is trying to find a way to get Lillard on the roster with Maxey and Embiid. So, certainly interesting as to how the Sixers go about the next phase. And listen, since Joel Embiid has been healthy, which he's been mostly healthy, by the way, in the regular season, after he missed the first 2 years of his career, they've had a lot of different stars around him, and it's never manifested itself into a conference finals appearance. You know, for a while there, they thought the homegrown path with Jimmy Butler and Markelle Fultz would work. Ben Simmons and Markelle Fultz would work. Then Butler came in a trade, and now it was Harden. And the results have been the same in terms of losing in the second round. So what do they do in terms of maximizing Embiid's prime and avoiding a punt year? Tobias Harris, that contract, we talked about it. People have said, well, maybe the Sixers have to take a step back in 23-24. You move off of Harden because you don't want that long-term kind of crippling nature of a big Harden deal on the books. And you can't move Tobias, so you just let him expire. And then next summer you look at, you know, restructuring the roster with more cap space. If they have to do that, that's disappointing, in my opinion, because it means another year of Joel Embiid's prime where you don't win a championship. And you would know that before the season even started. All right, let's go to the Diamond. Some baseball series this weekend that have my attention. That's next.
You're back with First Name Sports on the Sports Map Radio Network.
Live from the Sports Map Radio Studios, here's Greg Frank.
All right, well, a lot of times I like to try and center baseball segments. I think the weekends are good times to do them because, or coming back from a weekend, because you either have a whole weekend to preview or a whole weekend to react to of games. And I like to try and look around the schedule and see what's of note on the diamond. And as we inch ever closer to the All-Star break, and we'll react to some of the All-Star starters a little bit later on in the show, we do have, I think, three series. We have one interleague series, one series going on in Texas, and another series going on down in the southeastern United States that I am, all three, for different reasons, are interesting this weekend. And so I wanted to highlight each of the three as we roll along here on a Friday afternoon. And the first one is the Miami Marlins going to Atlanta to take on the Braves, as these are the top two teams in the National League East. And they've been red hot. I mean, the Phillies have gone, well, just went 18-6 in the month of June. I guess they got one more game tonight in June, but 18-6 last 24, and they can't pick up any ground on the Marlins or the Braves. And the reason why this series in particular this weekend I think is interesting, because Miami is a team that I've long felt, yeah, okay, overachieving. You know, for a while I thought they were the NL East version of the Pirates. If you'll remember, Pittsburgh was in first place for at least over a month. It might have been closer to 2 months. And the month of June did not treat the Buccos well. And now it looks like Cincinnati and Milwaukee are going to duke it out for the National League Central. And that's what I thought would happen with the Marlins. But they're not going away. Matter of fact, they're only kind of furthering the idea that they're here to stay with the way they've been playing. They've won five in a row. So have the Braves. And Miami is up to a, I think this is a season high, 14 games over 500. So, you know, they finally, if they, I mean, we'll see what happens this weekend, but they finally have a run differential out of the negatives. They're exactly even on the run differential. 334 runs scored and 334 runs allowed. And that's always a barometer that I look at, because sometimes it can tell you if you're you know, winning a lot of close games and losing a lot of blowouts, that your record might be a little bit phony. But now their run differential is dead even. And the Braves are far and away the best team in the National League, and they might be the best team in baseball. So when it comes to a test, when it comes to a litmus test, when it comes to a barometer for the Marlins, if I am to take you serious, I'm going to have no choice but to take them seriously if they win this series this weekend. And if they don't, then I think it further cements the Braves as just that team that everybody in the National League is looking up at. But if the Marlins go to Atlanta and get 2 out of 3 this weekend, yeah, I have no choice but to take them seriously as a playoff threat. And I didn't think I'd be saying that end of June, beginning of July. Astros and Rangers beginning 3 games tonight in Arlington. And the pitching matchups are interesting. Ronel Blanco and John Gray tonight. Hunter Brown and Nate Eovaldi tomorrow. And then Framber Valdez and Andrew Heaney on Sunday. So certainly a lot of those names are the biggest of names in the rotations for these two teams. And, you know, 5 games isn't a lot, especially when you're talking about an Astros team that I think until they are officially knocked off their perch in the American League, and, you know, more specifically the American League West, you should always assume that they're going to be a factor and that they're going to make the playoffs. But that's the lead right now in the AL West for Texas. It's 5 games over Houston. And if Texas wins this series, then it goes to 6 games. And you stretch it a little bit more. It puts more, you know, we inch closer to the All-Star break, then the trade deadline. There's more pressure on the Astros, if they do want to try and win the division, to go bigger. And it sounds like they're going to be one of the more aggressive buyers over the next month or so in Major League Baseball. But listen, the Rangers have established themselves as far as I'm concerned. They are to be taken. You know, I talked about how the Marlins, you know, like, cute little 2 months, but you got to win this series for me to really think that you're a playoff team. If you don't, then I'll still kind of have some skepticism. I don't have any skepticism about Texas. You know, they're definitely an overachiever. I think that at best, maybe they could, people went into the year thinking they could compete for a wild card, and that was with Jacob DeGrom. The fact that they're 17 games over 500, their offense has been absolutely raking. 483 runs scored is the most in Major League Baseball. Yeah, I'm going to take them seriously. And so in a weird way, it's the Astros that have to make a statement this weekend. You know, they need to draw the line in the sand and give a worse deal here type of message to the Rangers. Otherwise, you know, the Rangers win this series. As I said, the lead goes to 6 in the American League West, and it feels like they're just the better team, which I didn't think we'd be saying this year. So I think pretty important for the Astros just to confirm what I think we're saying right now, that this division's not over. The Astros will still find ways to compete into August and September for another division title. Guys like Christian Javier will figure it out for them. But, you know, they'll go out and do some things at the deadline. When you've done as much winning as Houston has the last 6-7 years, you deserve that benefit of the doubt. But 2023, right now, Texas is better. I mean, that you can't argue that. So how much better are the Rangers? And we'll talk about that more with Kennedy Landry in the next segment. Covers the Rangers for MLB.com. And then another series involving an AL West team that has my attention is the Arizona Diamondbacks going to Anaheim to take on the Angels. Because much like Texas, I think Arizona is legit. I think Arizona, I talked about Texas scoring a bunch of runs. Arizona scored 420 runs. That's second in the National League behind only the Braves. So we'll get to the All-Stars a little bit later. Corbin Carroll is going to start the All-Star game as a rookie. Arizona, I think, is legit. You know, Zach Gallen has a chance to win the Cy Young Award. And so the team here is the Angels. They've now lost back-to-back games to the White Sox. They still ended up splitting 4 games against Chicago, but the White Sox are down. They're a mess. So you probably would have hoped for at least 3 out of 4 in that 4-game set. And if you lose this series and you start nosediving, you're going to lose ground head-to-head on Texas and Houston this weekend if you drop this series because Texas and Houston are playing each other. So I guess what I'm saying is, while Seattle has been far and away the most disappointing team in this division, if the Angels nosedive a bit this weekend, like, it wouldn't shock me if they got swept by Arizona. And if that happened, then I think you circle this little stretch that the Angels are on is when it all started to fizzle out. So just an ability to maintain staying power, let's say, in the American League wildcard race, because obviously while they're only a game behind Houston, the Angels don't get that same benefit of the doubt that the Astros get when it comes to, are they going to be able to hunt down the Rangers? The Angels have done nothing but lose the last 6-7 years. And so while we look at Houston and say, yeah, they're 5 out, but they're the Astros, they'll figure it out. We look at the Angels and say, yeah, they're 6 out, and in a week they could be 10 out. And when you got a first-place club coming into your ballpark in Arizona, that's the kind of series that could continue to result in a bit of a nosedive. As I said, they lost back-to-back games to Chicago. They're 4-6 in their last 10. I mean, you know, they're 5 over .500. So the Angels are going to have to play better than .500 ball the rest of the way, because finishing the season 5 over .500 is not going to get you in the playoffs. So if you just tread water for the Angels, if you're the Angels, that I don't think that gets you in the American League wildcard race. And if you start sinking a little bit in the pool, then obviously people are going to begin to assume, well, here go the Angels again on their way to 85-90 losses. Still 5 over .500, as I said. Otani's having an even more amazing year. But, you know, give me a reason to think that you're going to stick around in this thing, and that would be winning this series against the Arizona Diamondbacks when you haven't played that well lately. So a lot of attention on the American League West, and again, that Marlins-Braves series, if there was ever a time for the Marlins to really make a statement, it is now. We will take a timeout, and let's dive a little deeper into the Rangers and Astros as they begin a 3-game set in Arlington at Globe Life Park tonight. Kennedy Landry from MajorLeagueBaseball.com covers the Rangers. We'll join on the other side as it's a Friday afternoon. A couple segments in here on First Name Sports, Sports Map Radio.
Listening to First Name Sports on the Sports Map Radio Network. Live from the Sports Map Radio Studios, here's Greg Frank.
Probably the biggest series this weekend in Major League Baseball features the two Texas teams in the sport as the Rangers host the Houston Astros for 3 beginning tonight at Globe Life Park. To talk more about that and obviously the bevy of Rangers that were elected to the All-Star game as starters last night, we bring on Kennedy Landry from MLB.com, covers the Rangers. Kennedy, good to have you aboard. How are you?
I'm good. How are y'all doing this morning?
Yeah.
Afternoon.
Yeah.
It's afternoon.
Yeah, it is. That's right. Yeah, the game will be here before you know it, but we're doing pretty well. Before we get into the matchup with the Astros, just reactions to all those Rangers that were elected starters. Any of them come as surprises or pretty much where they belong?
Yeah, I think all four of those guys really deserve it. Marcus Semien has obviously just been, you know, holding this team on his back most of this season, hitting the leadoff spot, playing every day. He's been the best second baseman in the American League, if you ask me. And I think really the only surprise came is Corey Seager beat out Bo Bichette at shortstop. Corey missed about a month of time with a hamstring injury. But looking at the numbers, it's really hard to deny him starting in that position, considering what he's done since he's come back and even the time before he went down. So then obviously rookie third baseman Josh Young and Jonah Heim behind the plate, everybody in that lineup has been phenomenal this year, but those four guys specifically I think really deserve it, and it's going to be special for them to be there in Seattle this year.
Does Adolis Garcia find his way into the starting lineup as the Aaron Judge replacement?
I think so. I think, you know, White Sox, Luis Robert might sneak in there ahead of him, but Adolis did finish fifth in voting, I think, behind Yordan Alvarez as well, who's also injured. So I think there's a good chance that Adolis gets in there. It'll be really special for him if he does, considering he's really great friends with Randy and Rosarena. They were roommates in Cuba. They were roommates when they were with the Cardinals organization. So I think it'll be really special for them if they're able to start this this All-Star game together.
Yeah, that'd be pretty cool. Keep an eye on that as we inch closer to the Midsummer Classic. As far as this weekend, though, how much is on the line here? Obviously, it feels like a bigger series for the Astros as the chasers here, but I think the Rangers, to a lot of people, have already proved that they're the team to be hunted in this division. What can they do in terms of really solidifying their position atop the division this weekend?
I think this series really has the opportunity to, it can change the entire outlook of the division. The Rangers are five games up. We've got four games here in Arlington, so if the Astros somehow end up sweeping the series, they're just one game back of the division lead. So it's a very big series as it comes for the American League West, as well as just the entire American League as a whole. Obviously, you've got Rangers ace Nathan Eovaldi, John Gray starting this week as well, Martin Perez, who just somehow always decides to pitch the game of his life against Houston. So I think there's a lot on the line here, and I think, yes, the Rangers may have proven that they are the team to be chased after right now in the American League, especially in the American League West, but there's a lot of baseball left to play. This is far from being, you know, tied up and done for come September. So this is a very important series at this point in the season, and we may end up looking back on it in September and October as one that does really change the outlook of the entire division.
How do you kind of see these two teams matching up? Because we haven't seen them head-to-head, I don't think at all, this season. And I feel like we've been looking at the standings waiting for this. So how do you think they match up?
Yeah, the Rangers did take two of three. I think it was back in early May.
That's right. It was back at Minute Maid, yeah.
Right. So I think this is kind of a different team for the Rangers specifically since that time back out in Houston. Corey Seager was down during that series. He was not starting. Jacob deGrom did pitch then, and he's not pitching now, so I guess there's not really much of a difference there. And I know there's been a lot of things going on Houston's side, some injuries and a little shuffling there. Jose Altuve is back for you guys, so that does change the outlook a little bit. But I think this is a very interesting matchup as it comes, especially on the pitching end, how things play out. I can see this being a very low-scoring series between the starting pitchers. The Rangers' bullpen has had a bit of a roller coaster these last few months, honestly. So, you know, if Houston can knock out a starting pitcher early, they may be able to you know, make a run in the late innings. But it'll be very interesting to see how these two teams match up, especially, you know, things are slightly different than the last time they played each other.
You know, you mentioned maybe some lower scoring games, and that's something that I think might bode well for Houston because, you know, obviously the Rangers have been an offensive juggernaut, and we just talked about all those guys that are starting in the All-Star game. So is that kind of a game script that is more conducive for the Astros if they do keep these games, you know, 3-2, 4-3?
Yeah, absolutely. I think the Rangers have a losing record in one-run games and two-run games at this point, but they do also have a lot of blowouts. So I don't know if there's really one way, one script to defeating this Rangers team. But if you do keep them, you know, low scoring, they've really struggled with runners in scoring position lately. They were performing at historic numbers in May and kind of, you know, have come back down to earth in June. Maybe a little further down than earth. They're kind of performing well under average with runners in scoring position. So they had a lot of home runs this week against Detroit, but they were all solo home runs and there was nobody on base for it. So I think that is something that, you know, you keep these games, you know, low scoring and close, that bodes better for Houston than it does for Texas.
What are the Rangers, I mean, you're around the team, what are they saying about this series? I mean, is there like a quiet confidence here, or is there like a respect of, hey, it's still the defending champs, they've been the team that everybody's been trying to knock off in this division? Just what's the mindset and attitude like for the Rangers?
I think it's a little bit of both. Obviously, there's no denying that this is a very big series. I think they recognize that and they understand that, especially the guys who've been around this team for quite a few years. And there is a recognition that, yes, Houston, they are the defending champs, but, hey, we're on top right now. We have to continue to assert that we are on top. There's a lot of baseball left to play, and the Rangers know that. But I think they recognize the immensity of this series, I guess you would say, especially just the two teams. Anytime these two teams face off, it's a big deal, even in these last few years when the Rangers were not up to the same caliber, I guess you would say. But I think there is a confidence that they come into, and it's a confidence that this team specifically has carried into every series, no matter who they're playing. And I think that's really, again, different than the last few years being around this team.
Kennedy Landry, our guest here, covers the Rangers for MLB.com. And, Kennedy, I want to get your perspective on where we're headed with this race. Obviously, a lot this weekend will dictate where the roadmap takes us in the second half of the year. But is this something that you see tightening into the second half, and this is something that goes down to the final days of the regular season? Or do you think the Rangers open things up a little bit more, or perhaps maybe it just sits at five most of the year and they're able to kind of wrap this up the last week of the regular season, but it's never all that close in terms of the Astros winning the division? How do you see the last 80-85 games?
Yeah, I think you hit it on the nail on the head there. I feel like this is going to sit around, you know, 3 to 6 games the entire time. That's, you know, the kind of vibe I get from watching a lot of Houston, even a lot of Anaheim right now. They're right on Houston's tails, too. Just seeing how this plays out, how good the Rangers have been playing. They haven't had more than a 3-game losing streak this year, haven't had more than a 5-game win streak. So it's really not too much to have them separate from the pack quite more than they have, but I don't think I see this kind of closening as much as maybe Houston or Anaheim would like it to right now.
You know, you mentioned the Angels, and let's get you out there. I mean, how seriously do people take the Angels here? I know that their record says that they're in it, but, you know, they just split a series with the White Sox. They have the Diamondbacks this weekend. So perhaps they lose some ground and drift, you know, closer to Seattle than Houston and Texas. Just how seriously are the Angels worth looking at here?
I think you do have to take them a little bit seriously. They were in Arlington a couple weeks ago. They took 3 of 4 against the Rangers thanks to a couple of bullpen collapses, I guess you'd say. And I do think it's hard to count out Shohei Ohtani just putting this team on his back. And I know we joke all the time about the tungsten arm O'Doyle meme and all of that, and how Shohei and Mike Trout can do everything, and that's not going to be enough to get this team into the playoffs. But, I mean, having seen them, we watched them quite a bit in this division, and, you know, this team, this Angels team does feel a little bit different than the last, 5 years we've seen of Mike Trout's career, you know, of, you know, Shohei Ohtani being here in America as well. I think you can't count them out, even if it's just in a wild card, for a wild card spot. It'll be very interesting to see how everything plays out down the line. They don't feel like they're going to trade Shohei Ohtani at the deadline. They honestly might need to add a few pieces if they want to compete in the division. So, like I said, I don't think you can count them out. They maybe aren't quite on, you know, Houston and Texas's level, but, you know, they can make a run or two and get back into the thick of things.
Well, you mentioned the deadline. It sounds like all three of these teams are going to be some of the more aggressive buyers in 3-4 weeks' time, right?
Yeah. Absolutely. The Rangers desperately need a little bit of pitching depth and some bullpen help and a little bit of, you know, maybe even a bat if they really are desperate. But this is the best offense in baseball. I think they maybe should focus a little bit more on the pitching staff right now.
All right, there she is. Kennedy Landry from MLB.com covers the Rangers. Kind enough to join us in advance of a huge 4-game series. I forgot about that game on Monday as well to wrap things up between these two Texas teams, at least in the first half of the year. Kennedy, thank you for your time. Enjoy the weekend.
Awesome. Thank you so much. Have a good one.
Okay. We will take a timeout and we'll come back. A little disappointing. Obviously, a lot of this news in the industry regarding some ESPN layoffs, but the one that kind of got me was the end of a trio with Mark Jackson, Jeff Van Gundy, and Mike Breen. I'm going to talk about some of my favorite national broadcast teams next.
This is First Name Sports on the Sports Map Radio Network. From the Sports Map Radio studios, here's Greg Frank.
All right, well, obviously some disappointing news today for the industry, really. A lot of people that have gotten a lot of experience under their belts, big names, let go at the four-letter network. And the first one I saw was really the one today when I woke up and was doing show prep. I was like, damn, you know, that really, that kind of won't be the same next season. And I say next season because I don't watch a lot of the programming on the network that isn't live sports. But this guy was so integral to their NBA coverage, I felt, and it's Jeff Van Gundy. Let go, and I just felt that the chemistry that he had with Mike Breen and Mark Jackson was awesome. And there was a great level of banter and busting each other's chops and also knowing when to, you know, analyze and be serious about what was going on in front of them. And it was both funny and informative. And I feel like that's what we want out of our sportscasters, is to be able to find that balance. And I think that especially when you're calling a game, I mean, it's one thing for us as talk show hosts to, you know, build in our personalities into the show and also try and inform a little bit and enlighten a little bit. That's all part of the job. But when it comes to calling a game, you never quite know what the game is going to present. And sometimes it could be a close game wire to wire, and maybe you don't have as much time for the banter. And other times it could be a blowout, and, you know, maybe you sneak in a nugget as to, you know, somebody's career that you didn't know about. But then you also bust your partner's chops. Like, I felt like they had that good blend. And, you know, I'm not sure. I'm sure JVG will land somewhere. You know, there's talks of the NBA possibly returning to NBC if the NBA wants to get out of its broadcasting contract with ESPN in light of some of this stuff. So if that happens, I'm sure Jeff Van Gundy will be on the short list of hires at NBC. But regardless, I've enjoyed that team. And, you know, who knows if we're going to see them ever call an NBA game together again. Belmar, I'll bring you in here because I know we're based in Houston, and JVG, longtime Rockets coach. I'm sure he seems to be a little bit more personable on television than he was as a coach, but how do you guys feel locally about Jeff Van Gundy?
Yeah, I'm sure. And you nailed it on the head. He's one of the few that's funny and informative, and it's just nice to listen to him. You know, I never cared who was on the broadcast because I found myself not paying attention to the person mostly.
Yeah.
But there were people that stuck out. He was one of them.
So I guess when it comes to some other broadcast teams, can you think of others? Because I put some of mine in the rundown. Like, can you think of others that stand out for you in terms of, you know what, I do want the volume on here?
If Kevin Harlan's on anything, I
sure.
want it on. Besides that, no. I mean, I don't really care.
You're not really an announcer guy.
No, I don't care who's on it. I just want to watch the game. And as long as they're doing a decent job, I don't care.
So you don't necessarily you think it seems like from what you're saying, you believe that it's a very down the middle job. And as long as you don't hinder the broadcast, you're not going to really aid it a ton. Like, you're not going to do it anything the other way. Like, it's just call the game.
Well, you can't, but you can stand out to me. Like, Kevin Harlan has always stood out for doing going above and beyond, like calling the streakers.
But what
on
you're
the,
saying,
the field
right? Well,
and
right.
Stuff
but
like
what
that.
What you're saying is you don't think there's many that stand out.
No, I don't think there's many that stand out.
Okay, I have three teams that really stood out, and a couple of these, actually all of them now, are not active broadcast teams. Some of these individuals have passed away. I have a greater appreciation in general for Joe Buck as my years have gone on. When I first heard him call baseball and football, I like most people, thought, oh, well, he just hates my team, and, you know, he's a little over the top, or sometimes he doesn't, you know when to just let the moment breathe, and other times he lets the moment breathe too much. But I don't know, as the years have gone on, I have really enjoyed his calls more. And I don't think I enjoyed him and Tim McCarver as much as a kid as I should have. Of course, Tim McCarver has passed away now and was a longtime catcher with, I believe, the Cardinals and the Phillies. And, you know, they were not always cracking jokes, but I think there was a level of respect that you got with the color guy and the play-by-play guy, that they worked well together from a very informative standpoint of the MLB on Fox broadcast as they did. And there was just a sense that if those two were there, it was a big baseball game. And, you know, I think back to those great ALCS games in 2004 between the Red Sox and Yankees. And they were as much a part of that as the players. And I really enjoyed that team on Fox. NBC lost the NHL rights recently, but Doc Emmerich is probably my favorite announcer of all time in any sport. And with Eddie Olchuk, again, it was a very informative team. And the thing with Doc that I really enjoyed was his ability to fuse the different points of the game with good vocabulary and just, you know, make a word fit in terms of what a player was doing on the ice. And I called hockey games in Minnesota. It's a fast game. And, you know, being able to kind of, in the snap of a finger, come up with those words, and not just any words, but, you know, insightful words and, you know, a deeper vocabulary at his disposal. I think he was so good at that. You know, him and, you know, and Edzo was kind of the X's and O's guy that did a good job of breaking stuff down on the telestrator. There were a lot of times where I would just watch. Obviously, these guys were doing the big games, but if they weren't calling it, I wasn't as interested in watching it. So the bigger NHL games on NBC with those two were always a treat. And then the last broadcast team that I thought of that I really enjoyed, for me, it was the end of his broadcasting career. But it was Monday Night Football, and eventually then Sunday Night Football, they bumped over to NBC. But Al Michaels and John Madden together. And I would always record the Monday Night Football when it was the Eagles and I couldn't stay up. I would get to pop the VHS tape in and record Al Michaels and John Madden. And usually I would wake up and turn the radio on and hear the score, but I still wanted to watch the game. And a lot of that was because I did want to see how we got to the final score. But again, there was that element of, like, oh, I think more than any of these guys, John Madden carried that weight of, like, he's there. This is a big game. And, you know, he had the Fox Sports put the documentary out when he passed away. He had a phobia of flying, and he had the Madden bus go around the country. And I saw that and be like, you know, it'd be real cool to ride the Madden bus with Madden one of these days and just talk football with him, because there would be no shortage of questions that I would have for him. And he had his all Madden team and I forget what they called the player of the game on Monday Night Football, but they always release that and put it on the Madden bus. And, you know, certain kind of, you know, the breaking down of the plays and the boom that he always said when a running back would, like, hit a hole or a linebacker would get there and pop the back. You know, you didn't need the lower third on the screen, or you didn't even need to look. Like, you could just hear him and know it was him. And Michaels was still going good now. I think now Michaels is a little over the hill. But I think those two, I mean, I'm not old enough to remember Pat Summerall and Al Michaels, and John Madden, which seemed to be like the duo of duos in the broadcast booth. But, you know, for bringing it back to the present, like, these were the guys really for me with the NBA. I mean, yeah, Bellmer makes a good point about Kevin Harlan. He's awesome. But I always thought that the Kevin Harlan allure, and this is no disrespect to anybody else that he's worked with, it was Kevin Harlan. You know, that what you referenced with the running on the field thing, that was a radio call of a Monday Night Football game, which I don't know if he had a color guy, but like, you listen to that and you don't know who it is because it's all Kevin Harlan. And I just think that there was a fun chemistry with JVG, Mark Jackson, and Mike Breen. That's why for a while there, and the only thing that broke him up was Mark Jackson taking the Warriors job. And then when he got let go, he was right back with the gang again. So, you know, I can't remember their first finals call together, but it has to have been at least 10 years ago, maybe closer to 15 years ago. So see what happens when it comes to, you know, some of these next steps at ESPN and how they, you know, assign and divvy up the talent that they do have. But, you know, I saw Todd McShay got let go. I've enjoyed his draft coverage every year. So, you know, we'll see who else, if there's some more names that are Susie Colbert, longtime Monday Night Football sideline reporter. So certainly wishing everybody well that did get let go today at ESPN. We'll take a timeout and we'll come back. The All-Star game rosters were announced. I told you I didn't watch the show, but I did have some thoughts, and we're just going to run through the rosters and react a little bit to those as we roll on here. 10th inning and Friday 5 still to come as well. Fun. I like our Friday 5 this week. I guess I like it every week, but I thought the questions this week were particularly good. We're back on the other side with the final hour of First Name Sports for the week. Sports Map Radio.